tears because when I saw that in myself, I saw a nightmare. I have worked hard to successfully shake that off. If I hadn't reckoned with my past, it surely would have continued hindering me in the present and future. As I've learned with my dad, no one is completely good or bad, and many of us carry the potential for monstrosity. Whether or not we give in to this is determined by how we deal with our demons. My sense is that my dad was born with an ebullient spirit that was literally beaten out of him. My long-standing fear was that it would be taken away from me based on how I was raised. But that too was just something I finally needed to let go. The impossible. Chris, the same friend who, a few years prior, had told me that my dick was dry and suggested I turn to technology in order to have a more active sex life, apparently believed that my penis was better moisturized now, which led him to offer me new advice. "I really just want you to settle down with a nice black man," my personal Ayanla Van Zandt explained. "It's time, Michael." I immediately thought of old episodes of Living Single, in which Regine Hunter's mom would constantly call on her to settle down and put some beans in that oven. Chris's comment was both an encouragement to seek a relationship and a thinly veiled reference to a noticeable shift in the sort of men I had been dating. Before moving to New York, sans for that one Asian dude who I thought was mixed but turned out to merely have braided his hair and gotten a grill and chosen a name that screamed Negro League, I dated black American men exclusively. It wasn't that I didn't find other types of men attractive. Again, anyone attractive can get it. However, in terms of the sort of men I had been around socially and who responded to my advances, they primarily had been men who looked like me and whose experiences mirrored my own. Something changed when I got to New York City. It's not as if I suddenly became repellent to black men or repulsed by them. Throughout all these quips from my friends, I had dated a few. Still, it was Latino men who started to be the most responsive, who wanted follow-up dates, who engaged me as much as I sought to engage them, who wanted to have sex. Some of this was due to the fact that I lived uptown, where there are a lot of Puerto Ricans and Dominicans. When I first got here in 2005 to intern, people kept walking up to me and speaking Spanish. Outside of being able to tell them my name and most of the days of the week, I was lost. My old pre-AP Spanish teacher would probably be so disappointed in me. Once I moved here, the Spanish speaking only seemed to occur more frequently. So I did learn how to say one thing in particular. No soy Dominicano. As for dating black American men in the city, my experiences have been a little muddied. Sexually, I've attracted them, but in terms of dating and trying to force something more substantive, it's been different and more difficult for me. One scrolled through my social media accounts as we were talking, caught a glimpse of me on television talking about Beyonce, and concluded that I was too feminine. Well, he said he didn't do feminine tops. I do not call myself a top. I do not call myself a bottom. I have a preference and can be selfish if I don't care that much about you. But I don't lead with that preference in the context of dating. Because I'm in my 30s, and asking someone whether they're top, bottom, or verse seems tacky and simple. That's just a fake-ass progressive way of me saying, if we're not in a relationship, and you don't nag me to bottom because of love, it's not gonna happen. Because that shit is painful, and only Ja Rule believes pain is love. So yeah, unless we're in a deeply committed relationship that includes obnoxious IG vacation photos, good luck booking that night of me bottoming you speak of. There is also the issue of dating men who don't have a college degree, which sometimes results in slick comments about me being oh so smart. Or there are the educated men, often with more degrees than me, who know I am educated but do not find me as cultured as they are. I sometimes felt that way at Howard. Although I ended up loving the school in the end, when I first got there, I met people from Houston who were more from the suburbs. They'd hear where I was from and what high school I had gone to and would react snootily. Once a girl said, "Oh my God, you're from Harlan Clark and you went to Madison and you're at Howard with me? I'm so proud of you." It was a patronizing pat on the head. "You little hood booger, look at you managing to be around the likes of me." I can't forget the one guy that I really, really liked. We hung out a little bit, and then all of a sudden he said he wasn't focused on dating. Naturally, he had a boyfriend from Houston a few months later, and he gleefully told me this via text. A year and change went by, and all of a sudden we started to run into each other again. I told him it was Beyonce telling him to take the hint. We started hanging out once more. A few months later, he ended up telling me during the birthday dinner I treated him to that while he found me attractive and thought of me as a great catch, he thought we would be better as friends. You're like a lawyer in that even if you don't believe what you're saying, you will say it with conviction for the sake of being right. Like you need to be right. And I'm emotional, so that wouldn't go well. I raised my hand as if we were in class and asked him if I had ever done anything to give him the impression that I would operate that way in a relationship. No, but I just have a feeling. Man, fuck your feeling. I did go ahead and treat him to dinner, but I wanted the universe to reach down and trip him from the stool he was sitting on as he projected his own insecurities onto me. I do not always need to be right. I don't like to argue. I won't necessarily back down from a given stance, but I do not have a problem with being wrong. Being told you're wrong means you're being given an opportunity to better yourself and to be more knowledgeable. I try not to speak without an informed opinion, but if that opinion can be shifted, if not flat out discounted, for the sake of enlightenment, proceed, motherfucker, proceed. It's fine. In other cases, weird circumstances got in the way of dating. As in, we click, but you're moving to Los Angeles next month, so this is a waste of both our time. Or there is a vibe, but then you find out your friend blew me 2 years ago, and while that should not matter, it does to you, so fine, cancel the wedding I'm already planning in my head. I'd always been wary of talking about this out loud, but I did make an attempt to address these issues in a piece about single life for a major newspaper's online vertical. I wanted to write a nuanced piece about dating outside your immediate pool. I wanted to make clear that I was not a social studies failure, so I was fully aware of the differences between nationality, race, and ethnicity. Being black and growing up in this country often requires you to explain yourself in ways you shouldn't have to. I wanted to make sure my piece didn't mirror any of the essays that I'd read from black people complaining about other black people who didn't want to date them. Essays that fell into familiar tropes like, I was told I wasn't black enough because I grew up listening to Smashing Pumpkins, or some bullshit like that. Same goes for people who were obviously dealing with self-loathing. I didn't want people thinking I hated myself, or that I hated black features, or that I found certain ethnic groups to be superior. I didn't want to be lumped in with those folks who thought that way. Those types tended to have black Republican hairstyles. For black men, a cut that lacked a proper lineup, or for black women, some dry-looking ball of hair tied together in a way that screamed, "Help me find a hairdresser, my Democratic sister." My intent in the piece was to convey that I used to feel it was important for gay black men to be seen romantically involved with other gay black men. However, as someone who wrote so much about gay black male representation in mass media and what was lacking in it, I might have been seen as a hypocrite because my own life didn't reflect this line of thinking. When I told a heterosexual friend of mine who was dating a white man about this, she told me, "I feel like that daily. I'm in my first healthy relationship and it's with a white guy." My goal was to write something that essentially said I had to learn to stop think-piecing my life and stop clinging to ideals that didn't matter so long as I was happy. That was all I wanted. And I thought I had accomplished this until the editing process started. With all due respect, I do not ever need a white woman to tell me, a black man, that I might sound a little stereotypical, like a caricature of a person, because I mentioned a crawfish boil, Hennessy, Boudin, and a beat of beer. I am from Houston, Texas. My last name is Arsenault. My entire family was either born in Louisiana or was the first or second generation out of it. And Houston ain't that far from Louisiana anyway. Worse, the headline that the publication chose made it seem as if I never dated black men. After I complained about this, it was changed to imply that I didn't date black men most of the time. I never told my editor any of these things. I'm always very clear with my words and intentions. She saw what she wanted to see anyway. She tried to make me into the very stereotype I was trying to avoid. I already knew that closed-minded white editors needed to learn how to let non-white people control their own narratives and stop pathologizing us. So the only lesson I took away from that experience was that I didn't need to explain myself to begin with. Now, when my friends crack their little jokes, I tell them, I respond to the market, and extend them the invitation to shut the fuck up and mind their business. The market led me to Adrian twice. The first time was via Grindr, a form in which I never anticipate meeting anyone who will end up being of any significance to me. I downloaded the app because I was bored, horny, and needed a distraction. It was the summer of 2015, and after moving to New York and doing well for myself work-wise, I faced a common problem but under dire circumstances. A black media outlet that I was contributing to both in print and online stopped paying me. Because my relationships with many of the staff members had turned personal, my usual bitch better have my money stance subsided a little bit, and I gave the accounting office, stationed outside of New York, more time. That was a mistake. They ended up owing me several thousand dollars by then, and I was devastated. I used Grindr to pass the time and get a release, but that was also around the time said app produced the guy who brought fleas and or bed bugs to my goddamn apartment. I wasn't really using the app to have sex anymore, just to pass the moments between sending increasingly aggressive emails about my state of pay while trying to get work elsewhere. Still, Adrian and I chatted for a bit. We exchanged numbers. We texted a while. I could tell he was smart because he, like me, wrote in complete sentences. Some folks don't care for formalities in such settings. I respect everyone's lifestyle choices, but I prefer to write in a way that would make my old English teacher smile. We were supposed to hang out but never did. I wasn't in the mood to be around people back then. Adrian did hit me up out of the blue one time to let me know he was right by my place if I wanted to hang or chill out. I brushed him off. I told him I was going to see Nicki Minaj in concert, a purchase I had made for myself and Dre before this black media outlet decided to enrage my black ass by owing me all that money. I could have followed up with Adrian, but I didn't. I felt too much like a loser in those moments and was paranoid that the next time I invited someone over, they might bring rabies with them. The following January, I recognized his face on Twitter after he tweeted me. I was better off by then and had a clearer mind, so after recognizing him, I slid into his DMs like a thirsty thought who knew he had made a mistake. I had a new phone, but I still had his number. He reminded me that I ignored him for Nicki Minaj. He let me know exactly what I had missed out on. I was hoping for a second chance, so I asked him out. We met at some Italian restaurant on the Lower East Side that was full of white people, but that blasted a whole lot of future. When we were texting each other, it was flirtatious, and I got the sense that we were going to hit it off. We did not hit it off. When I arrived, he was waiting at the bar, wearing a black sweater and black framed glasses that perfectly fit his face. He was beautiful but cold. He went from flirty and suggestive texts, and even a tweet about what kind of underwear he was wearing, to greeting me like I was the arch nemesis on Real Housewives that production forced him to sit with to film a scene that everyone knew would end in explosive confrontation. It wasn't explosive, but it turned contentious when politics came up. We were right at the point of the Democratic presidential primary at which people were starting to vote. Picture it. Me drinking brown liquor and hoping to come across as charming when the conversation shifts to politics. I explained that while I am not especially fond of Hillary Clinton, I do feel that after the New Hampshire primary, she was most likely to win the states and delegates necessary to become Democratic nominee for president. I add that Clinton is more likely to accomplish her agenda given that months ago, she unveiled a plan to capitalize on Obama's use of executive power. I said that unless President Bernie Sanders tramples Capitol Hill like Godzilla, killing everyone in office so that we can start over in some politician-less paradise, chances were slimmer than a bad boy royalty check that homeboy would get much done as an executive. You'd have thought I said fuck Bernie Sanders, fuck you, and fuck you hippy-dippy asshole standing in the way of reasonable pragmatism with your strain of idealism that should be rolled into a big-ass blunt. Sure, when the Sanders insurgency campaign started to ramp up, I had found myself liking him enough to make a campaign donation that could have otherwise gone toward the purchase of a catfish dinner with two sides and peach cobbler for dessert. Did I think he was going to win the nomination? Hardy har, no. But Adrian did. And considering he was a politically informed social worker who loathed most American politicians, as someone from Puerto Rico, one can see why he would loathe the government of a colonial power, it made sense that he was one of Bernie Sanders' most ardent supporters. We had a heated back and forth about it, and despite his attempts to get me to feel the burn more, all I could feel was myself going flaccid. It didn't help that he started talking about how much he hated people touching him. In my mind, I was like, but you said... And you showed me that, and you... He smiled a lot during all of this. I'd never seen a more beautiful smile on a man. My nieces went for best smile ever, FYI. But beyond that smile, he was trolling the fuck out of me. Enter Beyonce, whom he trashed to get a rise out of me. I told him that I didn't partake in beefyism, so I would not engage him in this and pray for his taste levels. But he kept pressing, and eventually, I went back and forth with him about that too. We took the same train back uptown. It was crowded. We didn't even get to sit down. We just stood near each other. He reminded me how much he hated to be touched. So, I barely touched him when I got off at my stop and let him go to the Bronx. Of all the strange dates I'd had, this ranked higher. But I somehow remained curious about him. Dre was puzzled by my lingering interests. Wait, you still want to see him? I said yes, and so Adrian and I ended up grabbing drinks again. And then again, and then again, and we text a lot. We communicated a lot on Twitter too. He wanted to read my writing, which was new, and he continued to troll me as a Hillary bot while I encouraged him to enjoy the ride until Hillary slapped Bernie back to the Senate. After a while, he did let me know a few things. One, he was purposely fucking with me on date one. I'm a lot, so I need people to prepare for that. He also casually let me know he was HIV positive. For a subject that has scared me for so much of my life, by the time he made that disclosure, it didn't alarm me. Before I met Adrian, I was interested in someone else who I knew was positive. Someone regular black, if that matters. It does not. I thought that thing was going somewhere until he suddenly flipped the script on me. He was now celibate and wanted to know if we could just be friends. I didn't know why people bother saying that. There are some people who can meet others under non-platonic circumstances and go on to forge a lovely platonic relationship. I am not one of those people. I have friends. I don't want to have sex with my friends. Therefore, you're not my friend. It's bullshit. To wit, days after that guy gave me that speech, I saw him on Tinder. Just say you don't want me and leave it at that. It's sort of funny how all of your life you have this great fear of something. Only when you confront it, overcome it, and shake off those stigmas, you end up being told, I don't want you. Life is funny that way. But that dude turned out to be someone whom I liked the idea of versus who he actually was. That was not the case with Adrian. I found him to be gorgeous, smart, hilarious, and challenging in the best way imaginable. He constantly told me things that I needed to do or even write about. He was usually right. I hadn't known him that long, but I did feel that he was the sort of man that I needed to be around. He made me want to be better. He once invited me to Popeyes. Do you know how special it is to have a beautiful, intelligent, funny man hit your text like, want to meet at Popeyes? Bitch, that is how my ideal romantic comedy begins. Unfortunately, we were both dating other people at the time, and as I would soon learn, it was more serious on his end than on mine. He invited me to a restaurant called Angel of Harlem, where he was having after-work drinks with his friend. After a while, he randomly inserted that he now had a boyfriend, but that we could still be friends. I downed my drink, asked for the bill, paid, and turned to leave. Don't be a brat, Adrian said. My response was that I wasn't being a brat. I was being an adult. I had already been here before. I was not about to allow yet another person to know that I was interested, but also allow them not to commit to me. I felt like I had already wasted so much time trying to make something of a situation that was clearly not meant to be. Additionally, I had already messed around in the past with someone who had a boyfriend. Living life like an SWV song was not the way to be. No, I needed to find something that was mine. Adrian had made a choice and it was not me, so I wanted to get away from him before I ended up getting hurt. When I left, I thought that would be the last time I saw him. He didn't stop hitting me up, though. I didn't stop responding either. Soon, I was back to hitting him up. It proved all too easy for me to break that pledge to myself. He came to my birthday party, and I took him to a Puerto Rican restaurant for his birthday 15 days later. Still, I made it clear that this was going to have to end. The plan was for him to take me to some Puerto Rican restaurant in East Harlem that he loved for what was essentially a farewell dinner. But that dinner never happened. It kept getting pushed back. Instead, we met weekly for drinks. We text nearly every single day. He sometimes called me out of the blue. He warned me that even if I had blocked him on every social media platform and on my phone, somehow, he was going to show up to something I was doing and roll up on me like, what's up? I never tested him on that because I kept engaging him. While all of this was going on, I was actively trying to date other people. None of them were like him. And even when I tried not to compare anyone else to him, anything that lacked that same spark led me to do so. He was different from me, but we had more in common than I initially assumed we would. What I came to learn dating men of Dominican or Puerto Rican descent, or in his case, someone born in Puerto Rico, was how much they reminded me of country black people in the South. I have joked that most Dominicans and Puerto Ricans are just black people who order pig's feet in Spanish. But through Adrian, who did acknowledge his African lineage, I got a better understanding of why older black women always gravitate towards Latin men. I was tickled that he had learned English in the 2000s from, like, Celine Dion, and didn't watch black Americans on screen until TV shows such as The Parkers and films like Two Can Play That Game made their way to PR. He obsessed over both of those things. However, he clapped his hands when he was mad like every hood black girl I'd ever met. He grew up playing dominoes with his dad the same way I had played with mine. I learned that when he said pero like, he was doing his equivalent of every black girl and gay who loves to begin statements with, but I mean, in an elevated voice. He loved his dad the way I loved my mom. Once, he compared me to his dad while we were at a bar, which somehow led to both of us tearing up in front of cat daddies in the middle of a Saturday. What I liked most about him, and what kept me so close despite my misgivings, was that for the first time, I felt as if I was being seen without having to tell so much. With Adrian, there was a level of comfort and ease that I'd never experienced with anyone else. I didn't have to say much, which was fine, because by and large, he had such a big, magnetic personality that I relished consuming him and all that energy. I learned all this in the months we spent together, which turned into a year, then longer. We did differ in some ways. I tried to control my anger while he was a bit of a hothead, ready to go at a moment's notice. He thought Britney Spears' In The Zone album was her finest work and trashed me for liking Blackout so much. He only pretended to love Beyoncé, whereas I thought anyone who even pretended to entertain beefyism needed psychiatric treatment. We'd each endured our fair share of trauma, but despite our both having a fair share of cynicism, I tried to fight mine off, whereas he mostly gave in. He told me the story of how he contracted HIV. His live-in boyfriend cheated on him with his best friend, a best friend he shared a tattoo with, sleeping with the man I assume Adrian thought he was going to be with for the long haul. I knew the betrayal bothered him, but I didn't know the extent to which it did. As for why he didn't eventually choose me, he gave a number of different reasons. The first was to note that he was dating someone else, and it was someone he felt was going to be his boyfriend. To me, he shouldn't have bothered dating anyone if that was the case, but such was his right. In any event, as he pointedly said back when he first told me about this boyfriend, when I wanted you, you rejected me. When he told me that he had a boyfriend, I did wonder if the way he behaved on our first date wasn't so much about testing if I could handle him, as much as it was having me feel bad about making a mistake. He admittedly liked attention. That didn't seem right. Neither was the other excuse. I have to be the star in the relationship, and I wouldn't be that with you. Or that I was annoying. Adrian annoyed the everlasting shit out of me too, but we both cared about each other, and we each enjoyed each other's company. That wasn't it either. It wasn't until we decided to spend a little of the 4th of July together that we ran into a few of our friends. Again, black woman love this DeBarge-looking Rican, so my friend Sade and her Virginia black mannerisms met swimmingly with his PR-produced theatrics. Sade had already heard about Adrian. All of my close friends had. They remembered seeing him at my birthday party. People who worried about my feelings were not in love with this predicament that I had placed myself in, but they were more or less letting me cook in a mess of my own making. As I got up to talk to some other friends I saw, Adrian and Sade had their own conversation. I wasn't sure how he decided to pour out to her about us despite not knowing her well, but she circled back to me about something he had hinted at but had never completely explained. He often joked about having the kitty and dying, but I didn't feel he truly believed that. However, it was clear to me after talking to Sade that the manner in which he had contracted HIV may have permanently altered his outlook on love and relationships. He would go on to tell me that you would want a real relationship, and I cannot give you that. I got a better understanding of why he hadn't picked me. His boyfriend, whom he curiously started referring to as his roommate not long after this, gave him what he described as security. I didn't know what they had. I didn't want to know what they had. It is likely for the best that I never know. He made such a big case about what he assumed I would or would not deal with, but the fact was, he never gave me a chance to prove myself. Rejection hurt anyway, but with him, it was all the more painful because I never felt so connected to someone, and I wanted him so badly. Painful because I knew it had to end. Painful because regardless of whether or not he declared otherwise, I did have a say as to whether or not he could stick around. He admitted that he'd been selfish to an extent, but I had been a willing participant. I wouldn't be one forever. I wish it had been different. I don't like regrets, But I do wonder if I hadn't ignored him the first time, things might have been different. That it might have been me with him. I might have had the opportunity to show him that I could be whatever he needed, so long as he continued being what he'd been to me. But every choice I made was right at the time. And maybe we were only meant to share those moments in order to guide us to the next stages of our lives. If time and space will allow it, maybe there will be another chance. If that isn't meant to be, I'll carry with me the good feelings he gave me and the faith he restored in me as a result of it. I'm not sure when I'll settle down with a nice man. It still depends on the market. And above all, honest communication. I can't date Jesus. You care too much about what I think, she said matter-of-factly, as I tried to get my emotions back under control. Adrian had gone to the bathroom, and the mezcal I kept ordering had given me the liquid courage to call my mom and get something off my chest. I had told myself that I wasn't going to bother with her anymore. That she believed what she believed about homosexuality, and no amount of engagement would alter that. After coming out to my mom at 25 and being met with a disapproving, callous response, I didn't discuss my sexuality with her any further. That was, until I found the need to warn her that there would be a personal essay from me appearing in Essence magazine based on something gay-related, one that would include my picture as well as my byline. It was my way of saying, our last name is not common, and I look exactly like you. Therefore, prepare yourself for the likelihood that while you're getting your hair done, someone is going to pick up a copy of the magazine, with Oprah of all people on the cover, read through it, and possibly turn to you and say, is this your gay son? It also doubled as my way of making clear that based on this cover and a few other placements of my work around that time, I was actively working on boosting my profile, meaning more folks would know more about my work and the identity that informed it. I was fairly blunt, and from time to time, that bluntness could be read as vulgarity. For my friends in Houston, that outspokenness could sometimes be a bit much, so they offered a suggestion. Before I said something that they might think of as outlandish, I had to say, brace yourselves. On this call, I was trying to let my mom know that if all went to plan, more folks would know about me, and that would include knowing about my sexuality. So yeah, ma'am, get good and ready. I tried to be civil with my approach. I tried to talk about God and difference of opinion. I stressed that I thought that no matter how she felt, especially about how I had stopped going to church, I felt that God was using me in some way to help create dialogue, to try to bring people like us together, to not simply regurgitate dogma, but to explore it, challenge it, and not be so selective in what we believe. Biblical literacy of convenience had long bothered me. My irritation only heightened upon learning more about the 6 scriptures in the Bible, how they were idioms of their time, how the analogies and metaphors had largely been misinterpreted, how other biblical texts had been used to subjugate black people and women. I was hoping she would see the parallels now with her gay son. She didn't want to hear any of that. She was a person who missed the pre-Vatican II era in which tradition reigned supreme, down to masses being performed in Latin. She did not want discourse. She wanted me to quit resisting. After I had laid out my thoughts on the call, she'd offered a response that mirrored the one she had given me 3 years before. Am I happy that you're gay? No. I'm sorry it happened to you. Am I hurt that you're still gay? Yes, because I feel responsible. She then went on to lament about the state of the world, how people were trying to use folks to make what was not okay seem okay, but stressed that in the eyes of God, it's still wrong. I had to put my phone on mute for a second so I could get out every shit, damn, and motherfucker before I could continue this conversation. Did she honestly believe that I was a sucker, allowing myself to be made into a prop? Had she met me? She, of all people, should have known that everything I said or did was of my own volition. She ought to have known this because I wouldn't have been a Howard grad, an ex-LA transient, or a current Harlemite had I listened to her. I could not have done any of those things without her support, but no matter how strongly my mom spoke out against the choice I was making, if it was something I had decided was best for me, no one, including her, would steer me away from what I felt was the right call. And there was some bit about the family potentially abandoning me. She meant her side of the family, the only extended family I could say I knew well enough. I love all of them, but I couldn't give any less of a fuck if any of them resented me over my being gay. What were they going to do? Tell me that I couldn't have any of the cornbread dressing at Christmas because dressing was only for people who didn't commit adultery? I asked my mom what position any of them would be in to judge me anyway. She had no retort, or it didn't matter anyway, because none of them had said anything to me about my being gay. If anything, they were concerned about my well-being and rooted for me. It wasn't about them. No, this was her issue. She was more concerned about how a boastful gay son reflected on her. As the conversation went on, she went there. She said she knew that I had been born gay and that I couldn't help who I was. She was a nurse. She liked science. She was smart. She got that people were who they were. But she was a devout Catholic. Religion can make you suspend your better sensibilities. Its success in making the faithful fall in line, no matter how foolhardy a position appeared, was rooted in how great a role faith played in people's lives. I admire my mother for a number of reasons, but what I admired most about her was her strength. She was the strongest human being I had ever met. She did not need to be loud to be commanding. She did not have to be aggressive to convey how tough she was. I knew that strength stemmed from her faith. Her religion kept her going. It was her guiding light as she steered through all the murkiness her life had faced. I appreciated her dedication to her faith. I respected it. Sadly, she refused to see that her religion stifled me. I couldn't follow Catholicism the way she did. Her version of Jesus suggested that though he may have loved me, he merely tolerated me. The mantra, hate the sin, love the sinner, troubled me. Because if you were under the impression that being gay was inherently wrong, you were operating from the frame of mind that I was inherently wrong. You thought I was the human equivalent of a regular denim bought at an outlet mall. I was nobody's clearance-ass jean. My packaging was fine. She didn't think that way because she fell in line with the church's teachings. It was why, despite admitting for the first time to me that she knew I couldn't help who I was, she advocated for suppression. She cautioned me not to act on my urges. She remained afraid of what could happen to me after I died if I dared to live. You could act on them, go outside, and get hit by a bus, and I won't know where you're going. She didn't want me to go to hell, but couldn't see that to not be wholly human might fit my own version of hell on earth. Why would I acquiesce to the Catholic Church anyway? They were still trying to clean up the mess they had made by knowingly shuffling all those boy fondlers around for decades instead of rightly expelling them. A mess that could have been cleaned up much sooner if they abandoned that silly vow of chastity they forced on priests and that even sillier clinging to patriarchy that prevented them from recruiting the big pool of women who majorly populated their churches. The only insight I could get from the Vatican at this point included shoe recommendations and where to buy one of those bad bitch dresses priests were required to wear while performing mass if I ever decided to switch up my style. Knowing all of this, I told her that I hadn't a doubt in my mind that if a bus hit me in the next few minutes and I died, hell was not my next and final stop. She wasn't convinced. She stayed on that please, baby, baby, please accede to church doctrine stance. I so desperately wanted to scream back, well, girl, I can't date Jesus. My mom always talked about heaven. She loved the idea that no matter how much suffering we endured in this world, we would be rewarded in the afterlife if we just lived up to certain ideals. Once, I stopped her in the middle of one of those PNs to say, it sounds like you're waiting to die to live. You can have a bit of heaven now before life here ends. She smiled but didn't really offer a real response. We were alike in many ways, but therein lay the difference between us. I didn't want to wait until I was dead to get what I felt my soul was due. I preferred to go for it now rather than live life by rules I found restrictive, and that, based on one gigantic maybe, may yield a reward once I was dead. The call ended with my mom telling me that she loved me and wouldn't abandon me. Even so, her discomfort was palpable. She couldn't understand why I felt compelled to tell everybody my business. That registered as code for, I don't get why you have to tell the world you're gay and embarrass me. After that conversation, we once again found ourselves not speaking. My mom usually called me every year on my birthday, a little after 3:27 p.m. Central Standard Time, the time of my birth. As she said year after year, it was not my birthday until that moment. I look forward to those calls so much, but that exchange we had was a few weeks before my birthday. My 30th birthday rolled around, and she did not call me. Hours went by and not a word from my mom. Even my dad called. I ended up calling her. She didn't hide her disapproval and lingering irritation with me, enraging me and nearly ruining what thankfully turned out to be a birthday full of love. My friends made up for it, and I ended up enjoying that night in spite of the hurt. That hurt didn't go away, though. I felt it in the next morning, and the one after that, and the one after that. It took time to shake that off. True enough, she never technically abandoned me. In her own way, she was always pushing me to keep going. She didn't want me to flounder. But even if someone loves you, it's not the same thing as loving all that you are. I know that my mom loves me, but I'm just as aware that she always had a different vision for my life. Ideally, I'd be working in a more secure field, finance, corporate law, medicine, one that would make all of her sacrifices worth it. I would also be straight and married with kids. We'd all attend mass regularly, and she'd have us over for Sunday dinners. I might even be back in Houston. Maybe not directly under her, but close enough. In Houston, traveling long distances within the city limits is normal. But I am none of these things. I will never be any of these things. Not being those things makes me worry about how much I may be disappointing her. I fear that I have because I've always chosen a much more difficult path. One that requires a lot of sacrifices for a reward that may or may not come. And if it does, it will come a lot later than expected. To add being gay to the list, and knowing that as a gay black man, certain health risks remain, only heightens that worry. During the summer of 2011, I was going through one of the most difficult periods of my life. I was abruptly let go from a site I was writing for in a permalance capacity. That means they want nearly or exactly full-time work, but are too cheap to give you benefits, so you have to buy your own. And though I found freelance roles elsewhere, most of the outlets were not paying in a timely manner, and I was owed thousands of dollars. Such was the life of a contractor at times. Beyond those headaches, I noticed that I was experiencing actual headaches that made it difficult to stand up without wanting to fall back down in a ball of pain. On top of that, I was breaking out into rashes. They started on my hands and arms and then quickly spread to other parts of my body. The rashes on my arms did not look like the ones on my legs. The rashes on my legs did not resemble the rashes on my back. My lips started to have black spots too. Thankfully, I had insurance by this time. A couple of months prior to this, an ear infection had led me to a county hospital in Torrance, California, as I had been recently kicked off my mom's plan. The first time I went to the ER, I was told the wait would be so long that it would probably make more sense for me to come very early the next morning to make certain that I would get treated. So I did, and I was, but while speaking to my mom about insurance in the parking lot, I noticed a bunch of juveniles circling my car. Those badass kids didn't think I knew what was happening. I almost ran all of their asses over. My mom said it was time for me to get a gun. I reminded her that California's gun laws were stricter than the ones in Texas, so in the interim, I just needed to go ahead and call Blue Shield back. Pre-Obamacare insurance for a single gay man in his 20s was pretty great at the time, so I went to see a dermatologist fast. Bless my heart, I didn't ask black people for a recommendation first. That gave way to some polite white woman who looked like Diane Keaton's second cousin, but treating me as if she had got her medical degree from the damn fool school of medicine. Oh my God, you look just like Chris Rock. I bet you get that all the time. Actually, no, I don't. Back during All-Star Weekend, there was a little boy at the bus stop outside of my apartment complex running behind me yelling, "Chris Brown, Chris Brown!" A few bus drivers and waiters made the same mistake back in 2009. That's the only Chris I've been compared to in the past, and to be honest, I don't see that one either, outside of us both being lanky and brothers in big teeth. After settling her underlying question, "Do all black people look alike?" she said something about sun allergies and then offered another opinion. "My rashes might be related to syphilis." "Don't you have to have sex to get an STD?" I wasn't a virgin, but I was not fucking a soul. She said she was just throwing it out there, but that I should get it checked all the same. She also suggested that I might suffer from a common inflammatory disease and that I should have a biopsy done. I came back for that, and before they scraped my skin to get tested, she turned to the nurse and said, "Doesn't he look like Chris Rock? Madam, why are you back on this nonsense?" The Latina nurse shook her head no. I did not have whatever skin disease she talked about. I also did not have syphilis. I told her that's a good thing, as it would be unfair to have the effects of relentless weed smoking without the benefits of a high. And the same goes for having symptoms of a sexually transmitted disease without having any of the fun first. She laughed. I was serious. Maybe she knew that. At least all that was settled. Unfortunately, the migraines were still there, and fatigue coupled with body aches tagged themselves in for a pile-on. After giving me a cream for the rashes, she recommended that I go see a doctor downstairs about the rest. The doctor was an old white man who looked elderly enough to long for the days he could say colored instead of African-American. Additionally, he appeared surprised that I, this young black boy, was in his office. As he asked me to describe my symptoms, he suddenly made an interjection.
Are you a homosexual?
I told him yes, and then he proceeded to tell me that I should have some blood work done in order to check out if I had hepatitis C. I didn't know where that had come from, but it spooked the shit out of me. He said it so cavalierly, too, as if that was what happened to people like me. I had been keeping my mom abreast of everything that was happening, but when I heard hepatitis C, I panicked. That doctor's office was in a Larchmont area of Los Angeles. As soon as I walked out of that building, I sat on the sidewalk directly in front to call my mom. My mom was one of the few people I felt comfortable being emotional with. I wasted no time starting to cry. My mom may have introduced me to black doctors and dentists as a child, but over time, I'd had other doctors of different backgrounds. However, she only took me to doctors whom she knew and who knew her as a nurse. So, as I was describing the way he spoke to me, and the shift in tone and demeanor after he asked if I was gay, she tried to be comforting, but nonetheless noted that the reality was, with that admission came the chance that you would be subjected to people's prejudices. Prejudices that multiplied when you were dually other. As for hepatitis C, I was mortified. All that suppression of urges, all that denying myself pleasure out of fear of contracting something that could end my life prematurely, all the damn blue balls I had given folks initiating something sexual, only to pull my dick away as a result of my outstanding paranoia. Imagine not giving in to your feelings out of a protectionist mindset, only to find yourself in a fear scenario anyway. My mom tried to be encouraging. I don't think you have hepatitis C, but even if you do, while it's not curable, you can have a full life. We can figure it out. And look at Pamela Anderson. She has it. She's okay. My response was me choking on my crying and barely audibly quipping, "But she looks terrible!" That was more down to styling and makeup than anything, but it made sense to me in that moment. Pamela Anderson has since said she's been cured, so my bad, sis. For more than a week, I worried about what my life would be like if that doctor's warning rang true. I called constantly trying to get answers. When I finally got called back in, it was a black dude who handled the blood who told me that I didn't have hepatitis C. He looked puzzled when I asked him about it, as if that should have never been on my mind. That same doctor from before came into the room and then gave me that similar look. I reminded him that it was something he'd led with.
It was only a possibility. I didn't think that was likely.
Bitch, why in the fuck didn't you say that at the time, ho? He said that while my liver levels were off, there was nothing that gave him great concern. He then suggested that much of my problems could be related to anxiety and stress, so he prescribed Xanax. I took one of those at night and couldn't open my mouth fully without being in pain for a month and change. I was experiencing teeth grinding during all of this, but Xanax only exacerbated the problem. For the record, only Celexa and Klonopin treat me right. I will hate that motherfucker forever. A few weeks after all of this, I saw his old ass working out at the gym. I wanted to trip him on the treadmill, but the universe stopped me. I hated him for seemingly reacting to what he saw as a gay mannerism by throwing out the possibility that I had something incurable that would lessen the chances of me living past my 50s. I hated him because that fear made me turn to my mom and worry her. My mom had to endure far more pain than any person should have ever experienced, especially a person as beautiful, generous, and loving as she was. I felt like I was piling on. I didn't want to disappoint her. I didn't want her to feel guilty and make her feel as if keeping us in the home with our father was responsible for behavior that she didn't approve of. I don't know why she stayed with my dad. It's not for me to know. However, I know part of it is the family she made with him and needing to take care of us as best she could. She sacrificed a lot of her life for us. The least I can do is make her proud. To succeed. To be healthy. To not give her more reason to worry about me in a world that already provides ample reasons for a mother to worry about her black children. In the end, all of this guilt I've carried with me is centered on not wanting to fail my mother. I can escape fault over a misdiagnosis and someone else's biases. I am guiltless in that sense. But to choose writing for a living and to be unabashedly gay and write about being unabashedly gay and learning to reject the interpretations of Christian doctrines she lives by, that's all on me. I have to be who I am, but how does one reconcile that with who she is? What happens when I fall in love and enter not a situationship, but something that is purely mine? Will she not want to meet him? Will she shun me again? How will I react if she does? When Hurricane Harvey hit, I frantically stalked my family to make sure everyone was safe. On the night when the rain consumed the entire city of Houston, a little after midnight, I called both my mom and sister. You could hear the terror in their voices. They did have reason to worry. My aunt had to be rescued by Coast Guard helicopter. Other relatives had to be rescued. I noticed days later, a friend from high school had lost her brother and sister-in-law in the flooding. My sister had a two-story home, so she was safer than my mom. She wanted my parents to come to our house, but my mom didn't want to go. Still, she was scared. I've been through many hurricanes and storms before, but nothing like this, Michael. There was a specific way she pronounced my name. Her Lafayette, Louisiana accent had remained pure, in spite of decades of distance. I didn't allow myself to think this would be the last time I would hear her say my name, but in the days after, when I knew everyone was safe, I reminded myself of the fragility of life. My mom could be a bit morbid. She was always talking about death. Part of that was waiting for heaven, her reward for doing what she felt was right and living by what she felt was God's will. I hated thinking about my mom not being here anymore. But the older she got, the harder it was to put such inevitability aside. I want my mom to be here forever, but if that's too much to ask, I want her to stick around for as long as possible. I only wish that we could reach some sort of accord about that part of my life. I want her to embrace that part of me and engage with me about it. I want that wound to close. I have to accept that it may never close. But while I don't want to feel like I'm failing her, I have to acknowledge that she's right. I care too much about what she thinks. She may be my hero, but we have very different ideas about how we get to heaven. I hope she reaches hers, and I hope I have mine. If she never changes the way she feels, it's her mistake, one I can't keep trying to fix. If nothing else, I want her to know that I wouldn't be who I am if not for her. My dreams would have died long ago if not for her support. And I hope she knows that I know that no matter what has been said, it came from a place of love and concern. Neither one of us has ever wanted to let the other down. It's always been a testament to how much we love each other. Sweet Potato Saddam. It's hard to wake up to a reality that so many people hate you. It was days after the 2016 presidential election, and this white gay man couldn't believe that bigotry was so rampant in the United States of America. The fact that an apricot-hued asshole ran a vile campaign engulfed in racism, sexism, xenophobia, and audacious idiocy, and was handed the presidency was unfathomable to him. I smiled when he said this, and proceeded to raise my black hand and rub my skin. Trust me, I know the feeling. This was exactly why, as much as I wanted to see my new gay white friend and allow tequila the chance to temporarily pull me out from under post-election stresses at this happy hour mixer, I was wary about going. When it came to my closer friends, you know, the blacks, as he referred to us, many of them didn't want to talk about it at all after a while. After the initial shock, most of them needed a pause. Not many were ready to deal with what the election results signified. What frustrated me then, and what has frustrated me every single day since, is that we're supposed to believe that what happened was anomalous. Yes, a self-righteous FBI director made an impact, as did a hostile foreign power adept at catfishing on a budget by way of social media. The same goes for a superficial, profit-driven media more invested in the spectacle of a bigoted reality star huckster managing to get this far. However, as surprising as the result was, in the end, all Russia did was exploit the racial biases America has never truly addressed. Voter suppression had just as much to do with Hillary Clinton's defeat as James Comey did, if not more. Overall, fragile white people in desperate need of an ego boost are why he won. It's a reminder that after 8 years of a scandal-free black president and his gorgeous, dignified family, white folks voted for a malignant, narcissistic sociopath with no political experience as his successor. A man whose political legitimacy was only achieved after he jumped on and further publicized a conspiracy theory that questioned President Obama's legitimacy as an American citizen. A man with the intellectual curiosity of a dead gnat whose purported fortune was secured not by his self-professed business acumen, but by the licensing of his name, which only managed to mean anything again thanks to an NBC game show. A serial liar and an admitted sexual assaulter. References in various rap songs from black folks who just wanted to denote wealth and went with the known blabbermouth with lingering mythology notwithstanding. We never liked that asshole. We've long known he was racist. We knew what law and order meant. We never forgot what he said about the Central Park Five. A lot of us were aware of his sordid history with housing discrimination. Birtherism was still fresh on all our minds. He won all the same. He sold a white electorate the dream of returning the country to the state in which black people, Latinos, and Muslims all knew their places, where immigration was out of sight and out of mind, in which queer and trans people were relegated to dark corners and closets rather than standing tall on television or using the bathrooms of their choice. And overall, he made white people feel less fragile about their standing in America, no matter how deluded such questions about it were. The revisionist history about the campaign that promptly began after the election results would be hysterical if not for the dangers it imposed on the rest of us. All the election did was give anyone who can be deemed other a reminder that we are all hated that much. Yet we were collectively encouraged to give the president-elect a chance. I admire the graciousness of Crooked Hillary's concession speech. She declared that man is going to be our president and that we owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. I liked the purple suit she wore that morning, but not enough to believe that bullshit. I don't even like saying that jackass's name. Since he won, I've intentionally tried to avoid using his name. Whenever an editor has allowed me the chance not to use it, I put something else in its place. A list of every name I have used instead of the one on his birth certificate. Tangerine Mussolini, Habanero Hitler, Minute Maid Mao, Honeysuckle Lenin, Sunkissed Stalin, Sweet Potato Saddam, Bankruptcy Batista, Carrot Cake Chavez, Real Estate Hitler, Sweet Potato Pie Satan, Orange Moon, Peachy Paul Pot, Sunny D. Zedong, Tropicana Jong Il, Kobe Jack Furr, Mandarin Orange Mugabe, Papaya Batista, Parmesan Putin, Hoghead Cheese Hussein, Garlic Bread Gorbachev. Because fuck him. I owe him as much respect as he gave anyone not white, male, straight, and rich during the campaign. None. The same goes for his supporters. So many people in media, all of them white, have asked us to give his supporters the benefit of the doubt. As if they deserve that. As if the choice of supporting a monster didn't warrant an equally vitriolic reaction. We were supposed to understand their economic anxiety and not further brand them as deplorables, despite their vote securing such tagging. Of course, they each love to highlight that some of those people voted for Obama, the political equivalent of, I can't be racist because I have a black friend. For some, perhaps it is a charming bedtime story, but the reality is, to vote for Barack Obama does not mean you cannot be racist. Racists have laid down with those they hate, and the second they pull their pants up, they're right back to putting those they view as less than back in their place. A vote is nothing. The man they voted for is a bigot. If you vote for a racist candidate, you are either an unabashed racist or you are complicit in racism. The other immediate talking point relates to caution. That the Republic would survive because our institutions are stronger than any one man. Of course America will survive in the wake of a win for bigotry. Bigotry is what birthed and has long nurtured her. For the few black celebrities who lent their support to him before or after the election, Omarosa, Kanye West, Tina Campbell of Mary Mary, Jim Brown and Steve Harvey, to name a few, I'm as disgusted with them as I am embarrassed. Steve Harvey has at least acknowledged that he should have listened to his wife, Marjorie, and not gone to meet with him. In theory, I understand why Harvey went to talk with him, but as I imagine his wife made clear, that devil can't deliver anything to black folks but pain and grief. Yes, leave it to a black woman to know better. Minus the reality TV villain and mean Mary of Mary Mary anyway. It is remarkable how inept the administration has been. In the nascent period of this crock of an administration, very little has been done to remedy the circumstances that helped him ascend to power. No one wants to own up to their roles. Only a minuscule number of folks in the mainstream media want to have an honest discussion about how pervasive prejudices are in America. And then there is the man himself, who is relentlessly rancorous and has plenty of energy to stay that way, despite eating nothing but fast food and well-done steaks with a gallon of ketchup on the side. Evidently, evil makes for a far more potent stimulant than caffeine. I do worry about us. Us, the marginalized and the oppressed. The people who don't deserve to suffer even more because far too many white people will put their whiteness ahead of everyone's benefit, including their own. I fear what will happen with all those judges he appoints who will outlast him and chip away at rights we barely enjoy now. I think about the white supremacists with extra pep in their steps in the wake of his political ascension, no matter how disastrously it ends. And I worry about all of us who have to remember, with every single tweet from him, every sensationalistic and callous comment made, every poor decision from his administration, and every terribly choreographed cable news segment in response to them, that we are hated that much, and not enough people want to call a thing a thing. I, too, worry about those tasked with covering it all, like me. Do y'all know how tiring it is to find new ways to say how terrible everything is, how dumb he is, how vile he is, how much of a liar he is? He and his band of nitwits are exhausting on every fundamental level. And it doesn't help that there's a band of political reporters and pundits suddenly realizing that American politics is tribal, angry, and polarized. Where in the fuck have y'all been? A white cloud? Oh, look, I answer my own question. Who will survive Sweet Potato Saddam's America? Hopefully my hair follicles and hairline. Epilogue. Yeah, everything good. We good. In all of the years I've been in New York as an intern, a frequent visitor, or as someone actually paying rent to live in the city, I've been to the Bronx a whopping 4 times. And yes, I do feel like I owe Jennifer Lopez a sincere apology. Each time I've gone, though, I've been reminded about some aspect of my past that used to haunt me. The first time I went was by accident. I might have been paying rent in New York for all about a month when I hung out with some new friends that I met via Twitter. While drinking sugary drinks that gave me more of a headache than a buzz, I met some boy, quickly exchanged numbers, and, after a few texts, ended up ditching those friends to be with him, which led me to the Bronx. That was me trying to be less rigid about sex and more open to meeting men and enjoying myself. The second time was impromptu also. A year and change had gone by, and I was out with friends I'd met the old-fashioned way. One of those said friends brought his boyfriend along, whom I found out had a brother who owned a club in the Bronx. He wanted to know if we wanted to keep the party going. I'm not turning down free alcohol on a Saturday night when I don't have any other plans besides obsessing over deadlines or watching Netflix and then mentally punishing myself for not tending to said deadlines first. I could have sworn I had seen that club on an episode of Love & Hip Hop New York, but I'll just say if it was good enough for Trey Songz to show up for an appearance, it was good enough for me. In any event, at the end of the night, I got treated to a bit of nostalgia. As we exited the club and walked out to our Uber, a fight broke out in the middle of the street. One of the men, shirtless, angry, and incredibly attractive, tried to throw something through the car window of the person he was fighting. The car was in the middle of the street. They just decided to fight then and there. The image instantly took me back to Houston, where I saw Teddy, a classmate from middle school who had since transitioned, outside of a gay club, fighting her ex-boyfriend. That car was in the middle of the street too, and much like that fine-ass man fighting in the uppermost borough of New York, Teddy somehow found a brick and threw it through her ex's car window. In my mind, I was thinking, aw, it's just like home. On the ride back to my apartment, I thought about how brave Teddy always used to be, always certain of herself, never cowered to anyone talking slick. She was always brave that way. It took me a while to be even half as brave. The next time, I went to the Bronx Museum of the Arts to cover R/AIDS America, a traveling exhibition originally co-curated by Rock Huska and Jonathan David Katz for The Village Voice. That exhibit included some 125 works, paintings, photographs, sculptures, mixed media pieces, videos, and prints, loosely divided into 4 categories, body, spirit, activism, and camouflage. Much of what stuck out to me was one section in particular, camouflage. Focusing on the challenges many artists face in creating personally relevant work after legislation passed in 1989 that restricted federal funding for art dealing with homosexuality and AIDS. The same goes for the rampant homophobia gay men faced at the time. Facing criticism about the lack of black artists feature, the exhibit had ended up adding 3 by the time it reached the Bronx, amounting to a whopping 8. Still, the first thing you notice in the exhibit was Marlon Riggs.